All right. Record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel are present, parties present. You wanted to interrupt at this time the testimony of Dr. Zarnik.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's to put on a witness out of order. This is a defense witness, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any objection?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, often we have to accommodate witnesses' schedules. We have to deviate from the normal order. We're interrupting Dr. Zarnik's testimony to put on a witness who would have been called in the defense case but is only available at this time. Just keep in mind, this is a defense witness. Dr. David Walt, David Robert Walt, called as a witness by the defendant, having been first duly sworn, was examined and testifies as follows.
Would you please state your full name and spell your last name for the record?
David Robert Walt, W-A-L-T.
Thank you.
I'm Nikki Espinosa. Dr. Walt, do you understand you are under oath today to tell the truth?
Absolutely.
And is there any reason that you might not be able to testify fully today? Is there any reason your memory would be impaired?
None whatsoever.
Where do you currently live?
I live in Lexington, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston.
Where are you currently employed?
I'm employed at Tufts University, which is in Medford, Massachusetts, which is also a suburb of Boston, Massachusetts.
When did you arrive here in San Diego?
I arrived here last night.
So we apologize for making you travel on Father's Day.
I missed Father's Day and spending the day with my daughters.
So we apologize for your inconvenience. Why are you here today, Dr. Walt?
I'm here today because I've read the deposition of Dr. Zarnik and I have...
I'll object. That's argumentative.
That sounds like it's leading to something argumentative. Sustained.
Dr. Walt, maybe if you could start by telling us your educational background.
Sure. I received my bachelor's in chemistry degree from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I then proceeded to get my Ph.D. at the State University of New York, and that was followed by 2 years of postdoctoral experience at MIT.
And what is your current employment title?
My current employment title, I am Robinson Professor of Chemistry, which is something called an endowed chair at Tufts University, where I've been for the last 21 years.
What is an endowed chair?
An endowed chair is an honorary position that's bestowed upon a certain member of the academic community of the university for people who have achieved a certain level of stature, and they generally are given in recognition of one's accomplishments at the university. It covers my salary. So, some benefactor long ago gave a certain amount of money to cover this particular endowed chair, which goes on forever, and the university does not pay my salary. It comes directly out of the endowment that the benefactor gave long ago.
Could you describe your field of expertise?
I'm trained in organic chemistry, and my area of expertise is in the field of chemical sensors.
So, does your background overlap with that of Dr. Zarnik's?
It overlaps substantially, yes.
And can you also summarize for us, then, any professional positions you've held since joining Tufts? Is that your sole employment position?
Yes, I've been employed at Tufts ever since leaving MIT.
Can you describe any honors or awards you received in your professional experience?
Sure. Instead of just going through the questions, maybe I can just give you some of my credentials. I have approximately 140 peer-reviewed scientific publications. I've given on the order of about 300 talks internationally, so 300 talks at conferences and other universities. I've received awards from the National Science Foundation, a special creativity award. I received an award, a bioelectronics and biosensors award. I received an award from Eastman Kodak Company for special creativity. I recently received an award in glass science. I've received the Outstanding Faculty Award at my university, at Tufts University, twice, once in 1996 and once just last year for contributions to the university. I serve on quite a few government panels. My work in sensors takes me to Washington quite frequently, particularly recently to talk about briefing the government on bioterrorism and how one can use detectors, sensors to prevent bioterrorist threats.
You mentioned that you have many, many peer-reviewed papers.
That's correct.
Can you explain why scientists have to review one another's papers?
A peer-reviewed paper is where, if my students and I come up with a discovery, a scientific discovery, and conduct certain experiments that in our hands work quite well, we write a paper on that, describing all the ideas behind it, describing the experimental procedures for carrying out that work, and then we send that paper to a journal, where the editor of that journal would then select several experts in the field, and those experts would then receive copies of that paper, of that manuscript. It's not a paper, it's a publication at this point. It's just a manuscript, a typed version of our paper that we'd like to have published. The next step would be those reviewers would get those manuscripts and look at them and read them very carefully to make sure that the logic, the scientific logic in there is correct, that the experimental procedures that were carried out sufficiently well to make sure that we, as the submitters of the paper, did not miss anything, to make sure that everything was done soundly and that nothing was really missed in terms of the ideas or the actual carrying out of the experiments. Usually, then, those go back to the editor with comments, "I'd like to see an additional experiment conducted," or "those words are misspelled." Those kind of things come back. And then you usually get it back, and the editor looks at the reviews from peers, because peers means your colleagues who are also experts in the field, gets that, read those reviews, and sees that those particular reviewers either recommend the paper, or they say, "I don't think this is particularly interesting work, doesn't belong in this journal," or "this work was carried out in a very sloppy manner," or "this is excellent work and it should be published." And then I would get, anybody who submits a paper would get a report from the editor saying, "I'm pleased to inform you we accept your paper," or "we did not accept your paper, but we're willing to consider revisions," or "we don't accept it at all." So some decision is made on the credibility of the paper and the value of the paper. The peer review process is a way in which the scientific community makes sure that the quality of the publications remains high. That is, it's not just up to one person. It's not up to most to say, "This is good work and I should get it published." It's not up to the editor to say, "This is good work and it should get published." It's up to the experts in the field that know something about the kind of work that my students and I do in our laboratory. So that's the peer review process. It really is designed to make sure that things are done in a proper way and that mistakes are caught before they get into the public literature.
So, besides having your own papers published through this process, have you also reviewed papers of other scientists?
Yes, it's a professional obligation.
And about how many papers have you reviewed?
Oh, I would say 21 years, probably 500 papers I've reviewed of other people.
When was the first time you ever learned of Dr. Zarnik or his work?
This is a bit uncomfortable because Tony doesn't even know that this occurred, but I understand why you're asking the question. The first time was when I reviewed a paper of his while he was a faculty member at Ohio State University.
And he was not aware that you were one of the reviewers?
No. In fact, I should mention this entire process of peer review is entirely anonymous. Reviewers are not known to the people who submit the papers. So all the reviews that come back are in fact completely anonymous. There are no names associated with them.
Did you review his paper?
Yes, I did.
Objection. Relevance in 352.
It seems like it's... When was this, Dr. Wald?
This was while Tony was a faculty member at Ohio State.
In your own mind, you could just answer this yes or no. Does this have any direct bearing on the issues in this case?
I believe it does.
Then I'm going to have to see the attorneys outside the presence of the jury. Have some kind of offer of proof on this before I could rule. It's the first I've heard of this. If I could see you in the back with the court reporter. What is your offer of proof?
Your Honor, Dr. Zarnik has testified about his world-renowned status as a scientist and that Dr. Wald was the person who recommended Dr. Zarnik to Illumina, and part of the basis for his recommendation of Dr. Zarnik was his reputation in the field, his capabilities, and his impressions of Dr. Zarnik as a scientist.
So that's Dr. Zarnik that said Dr. Wald recommended him because of his world-renowned status and scientific accomplishments, right?
Correct.
I'm not sure that's accurate, but...
Sounds vaguely familiar to me from the testimony.
Generally, he certainly emphasized his world-renowned status.
They said Dr. Wald. On the other hand, they said Dr. Wald had some impact on recommending Dr. Zarnik.
Certainly. His name was submitted to Illumina. Dr. Zarnik's name was submitted through Dr. Walt. Dr. Walt will say, yes, he did recommend Dr. Zarnik, but when he initially, the impression he had of Dr. Zarnik initially was that he had written a paper in which he inappropriately attributed scientific credit.
Took credit, failed to attribute to...
This is back at Ohio State.
Yes.
It's 10 years ago.
It seems like negative character evidence. I understand what the relevance is, but it seems like it's negative character evidence. It really doesn't, Dr. Walt will admit, he is the one who recommended Dr. Zarnik, so he really doesn't impeach him in that way.
That can come later on, because Dr. Walt then later started hearing comments from Dr. Zarnik about what was going on at board meetings, what the state of technology was, will show that in his mind, it rekindled the memories of the prior experience he had.
I think it's too remote in time. It's like a prior bad act. I think that the prejudicial value outweighs the probative value under 352. So I'll exclude that particular bit of evidence. You may proceed. Your next question, counsel?
Dr. Walt, were you deposed in this lawsuit?
No, I was not.
Do you recall an attempt to schedule a time at which you could be deposed?
Objection, relevance.
Yeah, objection, relevance. Seems like that's irrelevant. Sustained.
Do you consider yourself to be a friend of Dr. Zarnik's?
I consider myself to have been a friend of Dr. Zarnik's, and he was a friend of mine up until the point that I read his deposition.
What is it about reading his deposition that changed your feelings?
Objection, leading and argumentative.
It's actually asking for this witness to give an opinion on credibility. Now, he's a very eminent scientist, but no one is qualified to opine on someone else's credibility, so the objection is sustained.
Dr. Walt, would you consider Dr. Zarnik to be a world-renowned scientist?
I would consider him to have been at that level before he left Ohio State University, but since he has left, he has job-hopped from company to company to company and has not really made any independent scientific contributions of his own.
Objection. Lack of foundation. Argumentative. Move to strike. He doesn't know the circumstances of any of Dr. Zarnik's employment since leaving Ohio State.
I think it would be more pertinent if you could confine the questions to matters about which the witness has knowledge, and then I'm going to strike that question at this time, and then I might allow you to ask a similar question based on the matters that he knows about, which will be revealed by his testimony. But at this time, I think there's inadequate foundation, so I'll sustain the objection. I'd like you to move on. I know we've already heard testimony about certain matters that Dr. Walt may have witnessed, and those matters about which he has personal knowledge. I think that's what you should ask him about.
Dr. Walt, when did you first meet Dr. Zarnik person to person?
I met him while he was giving a lecture, seminar at Tufts University. This is probably 10 years or so ago. He was a faculty member at Ohio State University at the time, and he was giving a seminar.
And between the time you met him and the time you recommended him to the company that became Illumina, what were your interactions with him like?
I saw him occasionally at some scientific conferences where we met or attended similar kinds of sessions because our scientific interest overlapped. And then we were supposed to meet for lunch one time at in San Diego at an American Chemical Society meeting. And we missed lunch and missed connecting together because Dr. Zarnik had forgotten to meet at the appointed place. So he was paying off a bet by taking me out to dinner in San Diego on a visit that I had here, and I was had a chance to collect on the bet. He took me out to dinner at a place on Harbor, a seafood restaurant on Harbor. Then he proceeded to take me on a brief tour of the company, Aurora, before dropping me back at my hotel that evening.
We heard testimony you were the person that recommended Dr. Zarnik to Dr. Stulpnagel as a potential hire for Illumina. Is that correct?
That's correct, to both Dr. Stulpnagel and to Larry Bach.
At the time you made that recommendation, did you have any basis to know anything about his ability to manage scientists?
No, I have no basis.
Did you have any information about his business abilities, his strategic thinking abilities?
Not really.
Did you know anything about his work ethic?
No, I did not. I assumed that having been a faculty member at a university, which generally involves working a lot of, contrary to what most people think, faculties and scientists actually work quite a bit. We tend to put in 60 or so hours a week with all of our teaching duties and research duties. And I would have assumed that he would have had a very pretty strong work ethic to succeed in academics.
We also heard you described as the person who is the inventor of Illumina's technology.
That's correct.
Would you describe what technology is being referred to?
This is a technology that's based on fiber optics. Do you want me to go into detail on this?
Just at a general level, so the jury has an understanding what was done at Tufts.
Sure. What my students and I had developed at Tufts was taking a bundle of optical fibers. This is the same kind of fibers, similar to the fibers used to carry signals, light signals, so you can talk on the telephone. And we had developed a way of putting them in bundles, creating on the very end, so there's two ends of these strands. On the very end, we create a bunch of tiny little wells on the end of each fiber, and then we come up with a way of putting very tiny beads into each one of those wells, so each well that was created on each optical fiber in that bundle carried with it a little bead, kind of like marbles fitting into a little array of holes. And what was revolutionary about that is we actually had a particular type of sensing chemistry that we put on each one of those beads. Sensing means detecting something. For example, we could put something that measured glucose on one bead and oxygen sensors on another kind of bead, but we could continue that by putting lots of different chemistries on different beads. What we had also come up with was a way of attaching a certain number of dyes to each one of those beads that enabled you to figure out which kind of chemistry was on the bead so that when you randomly distributed those little beads in the little wells on the ends of fibers, you could figure out whether there was a glucose sensor in there, an oxygen sensor there, or something else. That was the basis of the technology that was invented at Tufts.
How is that technology? Did you help transfer that technology to Illumina?
Yes. There were people from Illumina, both my students, former students of mine who were familiar with the technology, actually went to work for that company and had some familiarity with that. And there were some Illumina employees who came to my laboratory, got trained on how to do it. They spent time in the laboratory, and then they carried the capability back with them to the company.
Have you yourself ever been employed by Illumina?
No, I've never been an employee of the company.
So what affiliations do you have with the company?
I'm considered the inventor of the technology. I'm a director of the company, so I'm on the board of directors, and I am a head of the scientific advisory board for the company.
In those roles, have you received any Illumina stock?
I've received stock in my capacity as an inventor of the technology, yes.
About how many shares of Illumina stock do you hold?
I have, my family has, about 1.4 million shares.
And to date, have you sold any of those shares?
I have not sold any shares, no.
What do you view your responsibilities as a board, as a director for the company to be?
Well, I guess I have... There's several aspects, several answers to that question. The first is, as a director of the company, we have a responsibility for making sure that the company is managed properly, that the progress of the company is going along properly. As an inventor of the technology and as one of the few scientists on the board of directors, I also feel a responsibility, a specific responsibility, to make sure that I keep my eyes open to make sure the technology is developing and that there's, and that if there are issues, that I can contribute in any way that I possibly can to help with that.
Similarly, what do you view your duties to be as the chair of the scientific advisory board?
Scientific Advisory Board meets two times a year to review the technical and scientific progress within the company. I think there are five members of the Scientific Advisory Board. We meet, as I said, twice a year to look at the progress and to set up some sort of strategic, come up with some strategic thinking about where the next advances could come from and offer some support to try to help the company solve the technical problems.
What's the perceived value of having a scientific advisory board for the company?
The value for a scientific advisory board is it's almost like the peer review process that we went through before, just to make sure that everything is going along okay to get some outside people to come in. You know, you have a company and there's lots of employees who are, there's employees who are working on a day-to-day basis and they're very focused on the things that they are working on. And they oftentimes don't have time to just sort of take a breath and think about the bigger picture. What are some new developments that are going on in the field, in the scientific field, and in the technical fields? Are there things happening that we have an opportunity to contribute that may, in fact, help the company go to the next level of development?
You mentioned in transferring the technology to Illumina, some people came to Tufts. Did Dr. Zarnik and Dr. Chi come to Tufts to learn about your technology before the company was formed?
Yes, they did. Both of them came even before they had decided to join the company.
What did Dr. Chi do to learn about your technology?
Dr. Chi came to the university. We spoke for maybe an hour or so, and then he went into my laboratory and spent about 3 days nonstop working side by side with the students who were developing the technology. And then at the end of that third day, I took him out to dinner. I pretty much hadn't seen him since the first day because he was clearly... If you're going to join a company and you don't know if a technology is going to work or not, or you're not sure, what you'd like to be able to do is make sure things are working before you devote your life to it. So he was very diligent about making sure that everything worked with his own hands. He didn't even allow, by the end of the process, he didn't even allow the students to touch anything, just to make sure he could get these things to work, putting these little beads into these little wells, because it was kind of an unbelievable thing at the time. So the last day we went to dinner, and then he was off, and shortly thereafter joined the company. Dr. Zarnik came, and we met in my office for a couple of hours, and I gave him an overview of the technology, and he asked me questions about it.
Did Dr. Zarnik go into the lab and try the technology?
I don't recall. He may have talked briefly to a few students, but...
Dr. Walt, have you personally had any experience in applying for grant money?
Yes, I have to in order to support my students. I have graduate students who are PhD students, they are PhD candidates who are working toward getting their doctoral degrees doing their research, so they have to write theses. I have postdoctoral students who study with me to improve their scientific expertise, my average group runs between 10 and 14 people, so I have to pay their salaries. As a consequence, and in addition to their salaries, I have to pay for all the supplies and all the equipment to run my laboratory, so it costs quite a bit to keep that many people employed. So grants are the bread and butter of what we do. If we don't get grants, we can't have students working on our research.
About how many grant applications have you submitted over the 20 or so years you've been at Tufts?
Objection, relevance, with respect to Dr. Walt's experience with grants.
This sounds like expert-type testimony. Has he been designated as an expert on the subject of grants?
No.
So the objection is sustained.
Dr. Walt, about how much time does it take you to put together a grant application?
Same objection.
Sustained.
Your Honor, I think it might bear on the foundation and the ability of the witness to opine on the reasonableness of Dr. Zarnik's grant issue.
Isn't that the nature of expert testimony? Unless he's a percipient witness to the process, he should have been designated as an expert. I don't doubt his qualifications, but I think he hasn't been properly designated as an expert witness in this area. If he'd had personal involvement in some of these grants Dr. Zarnik has testified about, that might be different. You may proceed.
Dr. Walt, have you been involved in scientific advisory board meetings that were conducted by Dr. Zarnik?
Yes.
Can you recall how many?
I believe Tony and I were together at 3 scientific advisory board meetings.
You worked together to prepare for these meetings.
That's correct.
Just obvious, but you have attended all the SAB meetings of Illumina.
Yes, I have.
Can you describe how you divvied up the responsibility of preparing for these meetings with Dr. Zarnik?
Well, I'm chair of the scientific advisory board, and I've never been chair of a scientific advisory board before. I have been on other scientific advisory boards, so I've attended scientific advisory board meetings of other companies and other institutions, but I have not chaired one. And when Tony and I started discussing how we would, as the company founded and before our first scientific advisory board meeting, it seemed to me, and I think he agreed with this, that as the person who was responsible for the day-to-day scientific activities at the company, really it was his show, in a sense, that I would convene the meeting, but he would really set up the agenda in a detailed way and invite the people that he thought were appropriate to invite to the company. And that, in fact, is the way that the subsequent scientific head of science, David Barker, has proceeded on a very similar way in subsequent scientific advisory board meetings since Dr. Zarnik has left the company.
As far as the meetings that were run by Dr. Zarnik, what was your impression of how those were managed?
I would characterize them as being disorganized, not particularly productive. The last scientific advisory board meeting that he presided over, we had agreed on an agenda probably a week in advance of the meeting. And when I flew to California from Boston and arrived at my hotel at about 11 o'clock that night, the agenda was waiting for me at the front desk. So it was clearly a last-minute type of agenda preparation.
And can you describe for the jury who is on a scientific advisory board and if this lateness had any impact on the effectiveness of the meeting?
You want the specific names of the people who are on the scientific advisory board?
And where they are from?
Sure. Leroy Hood, who is head of the Institute for Systems Biology, probably one of the five most important scientists in the country today. Paul Schimmel from Scripps Institute. Terry Sejnowski from the Salk Institute, Clark Still, who just stepped down from Columbia University, and myself, and...
Where does Dr. Hood reside, or what...
Dr. Hood resides at the Institute. He works at the Institute for Systems Biology. That's in Seattle, Washington.
Was there any problem with everyone receiving the agenda materials the night before the meeting? Does that affect the running of the meeting?
Nobody could have had the opportunity to prepare and perhaps comment on the agenda. I would say it's more the appearance than anything of showing that this is not an organization that had its act together.
Let me back up to your comment about Dr. Zarnik visiting Tufts when he was learning about the technology. To your knowledge, did Dr. Zarnik do any experiments to research about your inventions?
No, he did not.
Let's go to this meeting you were referring to. Do you know when that meeting occurred?
I believe it was in January of 2000.
At the outset of that meeting, did Dr. Zarnik say anything about the lateness of the agenda?
Not that I recall.
And you also mentioned that you've attended SAB meetings conducted by Dr. Barker.
That's correct.
What is your observation of how Dr. Barker runs the meetings?
Objection. Relevance.
Overruled.
I would characterize them as being very well organized, very productive in terms of coming up with paths forward for the company, some recommendations, specific recommendations for how the company could benefit from the application of some of the recommendations from the scientific advisory board members. So quite a contrast.
At the time you recommended Dr. Zarnik to John Stuplnagel and Larry Bach, were you aware he suffers from mental depression?
To be completely candid here, which I know I'm obligated to do, the first time I saw the word depression associated with Dr. Zarnik was on the plane yesterday when I was reading the depositions on the way out.
Do you recall a breakfast meeting that you had with Dr. Zarnik sometime shortly after the January SAB meeting?
Yes, I do.
And do you recall what brought that breakfast meeting about?
I had felt there was, I'm not sure attitude is the right word. It just seemed as if there was sort of a lack of commitment or lack of luster that he was bringing to the position, and I was very concerned about that because Tony is a very enthusiastic person. I'm sure you've seen that. And he has, when he's engaged in something, he really is very lively about it and really gets quite animated about it. And I just did not see this passion for his work that he had taken on. That was evident during his earlier days with the company. And as a friend of his... And as I said, I considered myself a friend of his. I wanted to make sure that everything was okay. So I asked him to meet me for breakfast and to talk about it.
What did you say to Dr. Zarnik about that?
I don't recall exactly the words, but it was something to the effect, I started breakfast before we even ordered, or we ordered, and then I said, is everything okay with you at the company? I just get the sense that you are not as committed as you used to be.
What did Dr. Zarnik say to you?
He said, why are you asking me that question? That was his response, and I told him what I just told you, and he then seemed to indicate that everything was fine.
Now, was this all based on your observations of him during this SAB meeting, Or did you have some other basis for believing he seemed to be losing interest in Illumina?
On one of my activities for the company, when I got finished with my business for the day, at this time the company was in their former facility, so everybody was pretty much in one big open room with desks scattered about, and it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and everybody was working, except that Tony's desk was empty, and everything was neat, and his computer turned off.
Did you say anything about this to anyone?
Yeah, I raised that issue with... I just made a passing comment to John Stulpnagel, Dr. John Stulpnagel, who was at that time in charge of the company. And I said, John, it's kind of surprising. It's not the way somebody who is at a startup company and is in charge of the scientific enterprise of the company, that's not the kind of example that would set for somebody who was really enthusiastic about a company at this particular stage in the company's development.
Were there other scientists working for Dr. Zarnik that were still there?
Everyone else was still there.
Let me put up on the projector there a document that's been Bates numbered as Illumina 2022. It's not a trial exhibit. Oh, I'm sorry, dated December 15th, 99. It's Illumina 1993. If you could scroll down to the first message, can you read that?
I can.
If you could focus on the language that says, "Will do, David," in the center there.
Okay.
Do you see the language that says, "Will do, David"? Is that an email you received from Tony Zarnik?
Yes, it is.
Could you scroll down onto the response? I guess it's right there. What was your response? Can you read that?
Tony, I don't understand this email from you.
What did you interpret his email to you to mean?
I really wasn't sure. It sounded to me as if he was concerned there were things going on at the board meeting that people were talking behind his back about something.
Objection. Calls for speculation. Move to strike.
Sustained. What's the sequence of these messages?
It starts at the bottom and typically scrolls up, but it looks like there was an email from Dr. Zarnik to Dr. Walt, and it says in quotations, "Zarnik," Tony wrote. That was the message from Dr. Zarnik to Dr. Walt. Above that is Dr. Walt's response to Dr. Zarnik.
I think the first message was from me saying that the only reason we should have a dinner is if there's general interest and most everyone at the meeting would be able to attend. And then his response was, "Will do, David." First board meeting in which I was able to stay the whole time was a little strange. I'm sure the conversations were conducted, but if you would allude to items that affect me directly, meaning items which I should talk about, not at work, whatever. Then my response was, "Tony, I don't understand this email from you." And then his response to that is above there, saying more directly, "I'd value your help in staying on top of board discussions that directly affect me, but I was not in the room."
Is it typical at board of directors meetings to discuss the senior management team of Illumina?
No, that's management, employee issues. Employee issues are the responsibility of management. The directors don't get involved in those kind of things unless it has to do with kind of a big hire and compensation.
Let's move forward ahead in time to a meeting of the board of directors that took place April 24th, 2000. Do you recall that meeting?
Yes, I do.
Were you there in San Diego in person for that meeting?
Yes, I was.
Who conducted that meeting?
That meeting was conducted by Jay Flatley.
And was Dr. Zarnik mentioned at that board meeting?
Yes, he was.
What did Jay Flatley say about Dr. Zarnik?
The discussion came up at the very end of the board meeting, after the board meeting had handled all of its business. And the issue was one of trying to come up with some kind of compensation package so that Dr. Zarnik would leave the company under amicable circumstances, where he felt he was being compensated appropriately and the company was able to then break its connection with Dr. Zarnik.
Were any particular settlement offers or severance negotiations described to you?
Yes, they were.
What was that?
Jay Flatley said that his offer was for 6 months' compensation and 6 months' vesting of stock. And the board felt that. The board had a fairly long discussion about this, centering exclusively on compensation. That's all we discussed, was what kind of severance package to put into place. The board really, for purposes of just making this problem go away and having everybody be happy, authorized an offer of 9 months' compensation, 9 months' salary, and 9 months' stock vesting.
And did Mr. Flatley describe how he would communicate that offer to Dr. Zarnik?
He did not want to communicate that. He felt that the 6 months and 6 months was more than adequate, and I think there was general dissent among the board that that was more than adequate. But we wanted this. We really wanted this issue to end on an amicable, friendly basis. The board discussed how to present this offer, and as a friend of Tony's, I volunteered to make a call to him and to present this offer because I thought as a friend, I have no hidden agenda that he would listen to me.
By doing that volunteering, did you feel it would put you in any kind of conflict of interest position as a friend versus a board member?
No, none whatsoever. I'm a very honest, very candid person. Anybody who deals with me knows that if somebody asks me a question, I've worked this way my entire life, I give them the full story. I'm not afraid to tell people bad news, and there was nothing discussed at the meeting that I wasn't completely comfortable conveying to Tony.
For instance, did Mr. Flatley say he had intended to fire Dr. Zarnik at that meeting?
Absolutely not.
Did he ever mention that Dr. Zarnik was raising the issue of discrimination because of a disability?
No. I never heard, and nobody on the board, at least at the board meeting, ever heard anything about discrimination mentioned.
Did Mr. Flatley describe to you what had caused the severance negotiations to start up in the first place?
Objection. Hearsay.
It is hearsay.
It's along the lines of communications between Mr. Flatley to the board of directors. That's been put in issue by Mr. Pantone.
It's hearsay.
Has anybody testified about communications between the board of directors?
Dr. Zarnik has. He claims the source of that information was Dr. Walt.
Once part of a conversation's admitted, the entire conversation may come in. The objection is overruled. You may answer.
Would you repeat the question, please?
Actually, I've forgotten the...
The reporter can read back the last question, please.
Only that there was, as I recall, only that there was a desire for Dr. Zarnik to end his association with the company. I did not know where that really originated.
Did Mr. Flatley say anything about Dr. Zarnik being given some specific goals that he would not be able to achieve?
Absolutely not.
Did Mr. Flatley say anything about performance goals at all?
There was nothing mentioned about performance goals until the June board meeting.
So, after the April board meeting, what happened with respect to your discussions with Dr. Zarnik about the board meeting?
We arranged a phone conversation, and I believe I was in my office at the time, and I believe Tony called me, not really relevant, and I presented the board's position, and I told him that the board had authorized me to make an offer of 9 months' salary and 9 months' stock.
What was Dr. Zarnik's response?
He said that was not acceptable.
During the course of this discussion, did you ever say to him that Dr. Stulpnagel was very angry at him?
No. Because I never heard anybody express that Dr. Stulpnagel was angry with him.
Prior to this April board meeting, had Mr. Flatley ever discussed Dr. Zarnik's change of position at Illumina?
Yes.
Objection. Hearsay.
It is hearsay.
Did you discuss with Dr. Zarnik what the repercussions would be if he did not accept your offer from the board of directors?
I don't think the word repercussions is appropriate. What I made clear to him, I made this very clear, was that was it. That was the final offer. That it was beyond where Jay had felt comfortable, but the board felt that just to not get into any protracted issues associated with his leaving the company, that they wanted to make an offer that was closer to what he was asking for. Just to make this as painless for everybody as possible. At the end of the conversation, I said something to the effect that if he doesn't accept the offer, then I was not going to be able to intervene on his behalf, that I was not going to be able to really participate any further. So this really was his last opportunity to deal with someone who was a friend, as opposed to somebody at the company or at levels beyond my control. So I had volunteered to intervene and I offered my services as a friend to be able to sort of come to closure on this issue so we could avoid this kind of situation that we're all in here today. And he did not accept it. And I said, well, that's it. I can't do anything else.
Can you estimate how long this phone conversation lasted?
I would estimate 30 to 45 minutes.
Other than the severance negotiations, did you ever tell him anything else that happened at the board meeting?
There was nothing else that I could have told him because the only thing that was discussed at the board meeting that had any relevance to him was the severance issue.
Did he inquire of you about anything else that happened at the board meeting?
I don't recall.
Let's go to the July 2000 time period. Do you recall that Illumina went public in July 2000?
Yes.
Did you attend any of the IPO roadshow meetings?
I was invited to attend the meeting in Boston, which would have made the most sense because it was local, but I was actually traveling that day and I was unable to attend. So I tracked down John Stulpnagel, called him, and asked him if it would be okay if I attended the one in New York. And he said he'd check with Jay, and I think he put the phone down and asked Jay and came back and said that would be great. As the inventor of the technology, to see something go from an invention, a discovery in your laboratory, to something going on with the stock exchange, introduced as a public company, you know, was something that a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that I was proud of it. I really wanted to participate in that. So I flew down to New York, I stayed in a hotel at my own expense, and participated in that.
When you say you participated, did you actually present anything at the IPO roadshow presentations?
No. I was introduced toward the end when there was a list of people when the board of directors was listed and I was asked to stand up. There were several other members of the board present. They stood up. This was at the luncheon.
This was a luncheon meeting?
This was a luncheon meeting where there was a presentation about the technology by Jay and by other members of the Illumina staff to prospective investors.
Did you actually listen to all of Mr. Flatley's presentation?
Yes.
Did he say anything about the state of the technology, the decoding technology at Illumina?
For investors, these are business people. Their eyes glaze over if you get a little too technical with them. So it's kept at a somewhat technical level, but not at a very detailed level. There are details that are in the documentation that's provided, but at the presentation, it never got to the... The decoding was presented just as a concept, not specifics about how many or how it was done.
So, specifically, did Mr. Flatley mention anything about an experiment called the 768 decoding experiment?
No, that would not have been appropriate for that presentation.
Were you there when the Illumina stock began trading for the first time?
Yes, I was. That was the following morning.
And where were you when this happened?
I was at Goldman Sachs, at their offices, downtown Manhattan.
So you weren't on the floor of the stock exchange or anything like that?
No, this was on their trading floor within their offices.
Let me ask, I want to put on Exhibit 315, please. Do you see the message dated August 25th, 2000 at 11:15 to you at the top there?
Yes.
Do you recall receiving an email from Dr. Zarnik after the roadshow and after the public offering to you?
Yeah, I do.
Let me point out some language at the top there. It says, I encourage you to dig into the topic of coding at Illumina. Do you recall him asking you to dig into coding at Illumina?
Only from this correspondence.
So, do you remember receiving this email?
Yes, I do.
Did you respond to this email at all?
I don't believe I responded to that email.
Why not?
Because if you look at the date, it's August 25th, 2000, and I think my message to him back in April was pretty clear that I wasn't going to be able to help him with his whatever issues he was feeling personally, and this to me seemed like a case of delusion or paranoia, so I just ignored it.
Objection. Move to strike.
At the time of this message—
I made an objection.
Sorry.
The portion just seemed to me like delusion or paranoia will be stricken. The jury admonished to disregard it. That's the portion you wanted stricken, is that correct, counsel?
That's right.
At that time, August 25th, 2000, were you familiar with what was going on at Illumina in terms of coding?
I had to. I'm the chair of the Scientific Advisory Board and member of the Board of Directors. That was a critical issue for the company, decoding, and it was discussed at every single meeting.
So as far as you were concerned, were you aware of any problems with decoding at Illumina at that time?
At this late stage in the company's existence, as far as I was aware, there were absolutely no issues with decoding. In fact, it was quite the contrary. The group that was responsible for decoding was well ahead of the goals that had been set for them.
Do you see the statement, "My personal insistence on experimental rigor may be one of the reasons I'm on the outside looking in"? Do you recall Dr. Zarnik having informed you of any problems he was having with experimental rigor or being on the outside because of that?
Other than this document, no.
It says, "I no longer have the clout to drive this point. But if you want to avoid being part of a DrCoop.com debacle, I encourage you to check this for yourself." Do you know what he was referring to as far as a DrCoop.com debacle?
I wasn't really sure. I thought it had something to do with some dot-com company failing.
It says here, "You are basically not affected except for Jay's pronouncement at the April board meeting that I described my bout with depression, that he didn't believe me, and was about to assign goals that couldn't be met." Do you know what he was referring to there?
Now that I look at this, I may not have even read this paragraph, because as I testified earlier, the first time I was aware of, that this, the way it was presented to me by Dr. Stulpnagel, and he was very deliberate in making sure that, I recall he was deliberate with his terminology. When he raised the issue of health issues, it really had to do, that was the way it was described to me. He said, "Tony has had some prolonged health issues." This was prior to this memo. He never said depression. Jay Flatley never said depression. And in this particular, at that particular meeting that's being alluded to, the issue of health issues was never even raised. It was, the issue was simply severance. That was the only thing that was discussed at that April meeting. At the June meeting, which predated this memo, there was a discussion of goals that were set for Dr. Zarnik, but they were presented in the context of Jay Flatley presented them to the board and said that we're beyond the severance issue because that was the topic of our April meeting. At the June meeting, when we had the next opportunity to meet, we got an update on the severance issue. And it was clear that Tony was staying with the company. And in order to make that a productive employment, he and Jay had together set some specific goals for his performance at the company. So that's how it was presented, was that Jay said, "Tony and I have met and we have agreed to some short-term and long-term goals with respect to what Tony was expected to accomplish." The word health issues, depression, goals that could not be met, none of that was said. And in fact, I really need to interject something here. The board of directors of Illumina is a group of people who have the absolute highest integrity. These are people—
Your Honor, I object.
There's no question. I'm sorry, Doctor, but we have to go on a question-and-answer basis.
Would you agree, Dr. Walt, April board meeting, there was no reference to goals?
The April board meeting, there was no reference to goals. The only discussion revolved around the severance.
At the later June meeting, there was a discussion of goals?
At the June meeting, there was a discussion of goals in the context of that Tony and Jay had met and had agreed to a set of goals that both of them were comfortable with.
And did Mr. Flatley ever say that he thought Dr. Zarnik would not meet these goals?
Absolutely not. And am I allowed to respond to that with the comment I was about to say?
I don't know what you—
Hold on. I don't think it's responsive, Doctor. I know you want to say you already said half of it, but it's not responsive to that question, so you answered the question.
I think I'm done, Your Honor. I just want to check my notes.
Okay.
Have you ever seen the goals that Mr. Flatley referred to?
Just briefly, before I came here.
Let me show you what was assigned to Dr. Zarnik as his research fellow goals. Let me point you to a sentence that says, "Make a combinatorial library of all 10 MERS that can be decoded using binary coding scheme." Do you know what a 10 MER is?
Yes, I do.
Do you know what a combinatorial library of all 10 MERS is?
Yes, I do.
Could you explain to the jury what that is, please?
Sure. Could I use the—
Sure.
If you had, say, four letters, A, B, C, and D, this is what I do for a living. This is easy when I'm standing up. A, B, C, and D. You wanted to make a combinatorial library of all tenmers. Well, in the DNA code, in the code of our DNA, we have four letters. It's actually A, C, G, and T. I'm just going to use things that are easy for you to recognize here. What all possible tenmers would be a string of letters like a word that's 10 letters long. So we'll just write one of them. So there's one of them. That's one possible tenmer, one possible string of 10 letters of those four letters. It turns out that if you have four letters and you have a string of 10 that you want to make, the equation would be 4 to the 10th, which would come out to be approximately 1 million words. So if you took four letters and made a string of those letters, four letters, a string of those 10-letter words, you could come up with 1 million of those. So what that is asking, what that particular goal is asking, is for Dr. Zarnik, that was for Dr. Zarnik to make 1 million of those particular compounds.
Would a computer be able to generate those 10-letter words for you?
Yes, that would be a trivial thing.
How long would that take?
For the computer to generate it? A few seconds.
Dr. Zarnik was being asked to make a combinatorial library of all tenmers.
That's correct. So he was being asked to make every one of those 10-letter words.
Using DNA?
Using DNA, correct.
And based on the resources that Dr. Zarnik had available to him at Illumina, would that be a reasonable thing to ask someone to do within a time period of 1 year?
Actually, it's a very easy thing to do because you don't have to make a million, don't have to run 1 million different. If I had to write 1 million of those words, if I had to write the entire set of 1 million, that would be a very difficult thing to do. But it turns out there is a way to do this that involves running 10 reactions in 4 different test tubes. So that's where that 4 to the 10th comes from. You could divide this into a problem where you made it in 4 different vessels and you ran 10 reactions in each vessel. What you would do after each step is you would mix those 4 vessels together and then you would divide everything into the 4 vessels again, attach the next letter. So the way that would work would be you'd have a vessel that contained your first step would make A. So here's a reaction vessel. Here's a reaction vessel, here's one, and here's one. You would first put only A into the word, and then you'd put B into this word, C into this word, D into this word. Then what you would do, you would mix all of those. So in the next step, what you would have A, B, C, D in this vessel, you would have A, B, C, D. So you would mix all of them and divide them again into 4, A, B, C, D in this vessel, A, B, C, D in this vessel. And now you would attach A to these 4 things, and that would put an A on each one of them. You would attach B to each one of these, B. You would attach C to each one of these, and you would attach D to each one of these. So what you've done is you've made 4 to the second, which is equal to 4 times 4, which is 16. If you count, there's precisely 16 different 2-letter words there. If you repeat that process again, where you take all of those letters, put them all together, and then divide them again and carry out that reaction again, then you've got 4 to the third, or 64. If you do that 10 times, you get all 1 million of those 10-letter words. So that's called a mix and split combinatorial synthesis, which is very easy to do.
Is this what people refer to as combinatorial chemistry?
This is one aspect of combinatorial chemistry, yes.
Did you believe that Dr. Zarnik had expertise in combinatorial chemistry?
Yes.
How long did you think it would take to do an experiment of this sort?
With the resources that would have been available for him at Illumina, it would take a week or two at the most.
Thank you, Dr. Walt.
Anything further?
No.
We'll take our afternoon recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 10 minutes before 3. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinions about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 2:50. 2:50.